This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the One World Observatory.
Straight up the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
They're trying to answer questions about upward mobility in America.
He's a military strategist. It was profiled brilliantly by someone.
So I think if you could find this subculture of people.
It's a kind of form of life on this planet that we haven't really seen before.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. A few months back, senior executives from Facebook, Twitter, and Google appeared in front of the House Intelligence Committee, and they had been summoned to answer questions about Russia's influence on the 2016 election.
You had a foreign government apparently buying thousands of dollars worth of advertising to create discontent and discord in the 2016 election. So the bottom line is, these platforms are being used by people who wish us harm and wish to undercut our way of life.
Although, like most congressional hearings, it wasn't really about information as such. By then, everybody except maybe the president understood that Russian operatives had manipulated social media on a wide scale. The hearings were about how much these companies would acknowledge their culpability. Nicholas Thompson follows technology and how it affects us more closely than just about anybody I know. He was formerly my colleague at The New Yorker and is now the editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. Thompson's cover article, written by him and his colleague Fred Vogelstein, is in the new issue of Wired, and it reports in depth on how people at Facebook, right up to Mark Zuckerberg himself, are coping with that fallout. So you've painted a picture of a company in the midst of a massive corporate identity crisis, and you spoke to 50 former and current employees of Facebook, and we will get to that in a second. But first, one employee you spoke to described Mark Zuckerberg as Lenny from John Steinbeck's short novel Of Mice and Men. What did he mean by that?
Well, so the story was written by Fred Vogelstein and me, and we called all these people, and one of them was describing the scene after the 2016 election, where Zuckerberg is looking kind of confused, right? He goes out and he makes a crazy statement that Facebook had no influence on the election through fake news. And then he kind of backtracks and he's at a company meeting, starting to apologize, starting to see what happened. And so this person said, yeah, it was like Lenny, the farm worker who's just too strong, who, you know, kills things because he doesn't know his own power. It was just one of those amazing moments in the interview where I thought, wow, that's a perfect image.
But isn't it because people in Silicon Valley, unlike people in the Eastern establishment, which are perfectly comfortable sometimes with seeing themselves as besuited, powerful commandos who run everything, people in Silicon Valley who are not wearing ties and suits like to think of themselves as good and nice and innocent.
Yeah, that's very true and very astute. You know, at Facebook, they always sort of are a little self-deprecating when you talk about the power they have in the news and you talk about the power they have in American democracy. And so during the 2016 election, they saw that Donald Trump was using the platform much better than Hillary Clinton. To a certain degree, they saw all the fake news spreading that was helping Trump. They didn't see any of the Russia stuff yet. And the election happens, and suddenly Trump wins. And it's this moment of, oh my God, did we do that? And that was a real moment of reckoning for Silicon Valley and for Zuckerberg.
I had an interview with President Obama just before and then another interview just after the election. And the thing that he was obsessed with was not so much Trump himself, but obviously he was thinking about that, was that the way social media was manipulated by so many factors, many of them stemming from Russia. You know, kids in Montenegro running a business out of the basement to pump out fake news, and that this was distorting the election. How did Facebook get exploited? What's the story of that?
Well, so the way that Facebook has a pernicious effect on politics, it works in a couple of ways. First, there's something called the filter bubble, which means you become friends with people of the same political identity. And over time, you see more stories from people who think like you, and then eventually more extreme versions of stories of people who think like you. And so that's a discrete problem. Then there's something I call outrage amplification, which is that if you write a story and it says Trump is a monster or Hillary is the worst, it's going to get shared much more and it's going to spread through the platform because of the way the algorithm works much more than a sort more tempered story. And that gives an advantage to candidates on the extreme, whether it's Bernie Sanders on the left or Donald Trump on the right. It just means that those candidates tend to do better and build social networks. So you've got those two problems going. Thrown into the 2016 election, there is this big problem that people realized that you could just take malarkey and put it on the internet. You could write a story saying the Pope has endorsed Donald Trump, and then millions of people would read it, and you'd be able to monetize the ads on it. So those are the kids in Montenegro who are putting up these fake stories. And then there's also the Russia operation. So all of these things are happening. Now, it can't be said that they're good things that Facebook does. It does connect you to people, but there's also a lot of bad stuff.
So what was Facebook doing or not doing about the in other words, they see themselves as a platform and not as editors.
Yeah.
That was their position. So what did they do? They just did nothing?
Yeah. So at its core, one of the fundamental problems and one of the mistakes or maybe decisions that led Facebook to where they are is that they very much decided that they're a platform, not a publisher, meaning they would not take responsibility for the quality of information. And in fact, they would make everything in newsfeed look the same. So a New Yorker story goes up in newsfeed, it looks a certain way. A story from a publication that some kid far away makes up that publishes only fake news more or less looks the same. And Facebook did that as sort of a way to democratize information.
Now, the word democratize sounds great, but what's the danger of it?
Well, the danger is that without authority, without trust, and without that being shown in the packaging, right? In the physical world, you get the New Yorker and it has this beautiful cover, and you know that this is an established publication and it costs something, so you have to have a reputation. You can't just create a fake New Yorker and get it to a million people. But on Facebook, you can. And so they did it for what they thought were good reasons, and it led to these catastrophic consequences. So back to the previous question, which is what were they doing? They were doing nothing, and they were doing nothing for a couple of reasons. One, they had this really tricky situation, which is the beginning of the story. They get accused of being biased against Republicans, and they think the accusations are false, but it creates this massive storm in May of 2016, so shortly before Trump clinches the nomination. And after that, they're really worried about getting regulated. They're really worried about upsetting half the country. So they, according to at least a dozen people I spoke to, kind of had their heads in the sand about fake news and the Russia operations because they didn't want to see anything where they would have to act in a way that could be seen as biased against Republicans.
And when Trump is finally elected and there are charges that Facebook somehow influenced the election, Zuckerberg's initial reaction is to call that, quote, pretty crazy.
Yeah, that was a big mistake on his part. So what happened there, based on our reporting, is some of the people who work for him on the newsfeed team kind of did some calculations, and they're like, oh, X percentage of all content shared is fake news, and it's a small number. And so Zuckerberg is very analytical, looks at the numbers, and decides, that couldn't really have had any influence. And it was probably a misunderstanding of the way the news ecosystem worked. It was certainly a misunderstanding of the news of the mood at Facebook. So Zuckerberg says that, and the people at Facebook say, whoa, whoa, whoa. One person told me that when they heard that, they were worried that Zuckerberg was, quote, going to take Facebook down the pariah path that Uber was on, and they had to flip him. And
so, they were that frightened that somehow Zuckerberg's public image would be as bad as the guy running
Travis
Uber?
Kalanick. That,
yeah.
That Zuckerberg's reaction to the election was so mistaken that it was going to put Facebook in that kind of trouble.
He's no longer just a nice guy without a tie.
Right. And I think that starting then, after that pretty crazy comment, begins the education of Mark Zuckerberg, where he starts to think about these things much more carefully over the following year and a half, which is a lot of the arc of the story.
But it's a long education, and it doesn't come overnight. There's a rift that emerges in this article between Facebook's, the employees' vision of what Facebook is and should be, and Zuckerberg's vision.
Yeah, I mean, that is the rift that you know, one of the dynamics that's most interesting in Silicon Valley right now is that the place where you can put the most pressure on executives comes from the engineers. And if Facebook becomes a place where 28-year-old smart engineers don't want to work because they think they're harming the world, then Facebook's in really big trouble. So if the meme starts to spread that Facebook is making the world worse, right, by making us depressed, by, you know, tearing apart American democracy, by
distorting reality.
By distorting reality so nobody knows what's true and what's not. And in fact, once former Facebook executives start to directly say that, that's a real problem for Facebook.
The piece in some way is a fable, an exemplary fable about criticism and the ability or inability to listen to it. Certain kinds of critics don't seem to penetrate Facebook's consciousness, whereas different kinds of critics do. There's a kind of insider-outsider dynamic going on.
Yeah. You know, it came up actually recently in a conversation with somebody where we're talking about an outside critic who's very eloquent, and the executive is like, they didn't build anything. They don't matter. And so there are a lot of people who Facebook kind of has dismissed. You know, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't listen to journalists and media executives. They don't pay attention to, with one exception, Mr. Murdoch, who we can get to, but they do listen to.
Well, hang on there. Rupert Murdoch is a presence in this piece. Why is Rupert Murdoch somebody that Mark Zuckerberg listens to?
Well, this is one of the more interesting things that we found.
It can't be ideological.
It's power and influence. So Zuckerberg, according to our reporting, in 2007 became convinced that Rupert Murdoch had basically gotten sock puppets to lead Richard Blumenthal to lead a pedophilic investigation into Facebook. In other words, that Murdoch, who at the time ran MySpace, had gotten people to kind of pretend to be concerned parents, get MySpace executives, to write letters to Richard Blumenthal in the New York Times, which then led to an investigation into Facebook. And that, to Zuckerberg and his top management team, and very few people knew about this, convinced them that Murdoch was skilled in the dark arts. So then jump forward. So then it's the summer of 16.
Even though Murdoch lost out to them and MySpace crumbled in the
MySpace disappears, Zuckerberg destroys it. But they know that, oh, this guy, he plays at a high level. So in the summer of 16, Sun Valley, this had never been reported before, Murdoch goes into a villa with Zuck and Sandberg and Dan Rose, and he's there with Robert Thompson, and he says, you guys are killing the news industry, you know, and you need to do much better. And, you know, there wasn't an explicit threat that they would use their newspapers and media to criticize Facebook and to say that Facebook should be regulated. In fact, News Corp would completely deny that and say that's atrocious. But Zuckerberg left thinking, wait, Murdoch is mad. Murdoch has all this power and he controls all these newspapers who can write about, I don't know, antitrust regulation. And so Zuckerberg goes back in a panic. And that's one of the things that starts Facebook to start trying to reconsider its relationship to the news industry. And then, you know, Murdoch has continued to be an extremely articulate critic, as has Robert Thompson. Very tough, tougher than almost anybody. And we then reported a third scene that hadn't been reported, which is in end of 17, where there's a big meeting at the News Corp headquarters, and Zuckerberg gives a toast praising Murdoch and saying, I've learned so much, and I've read a biography, and describing a tennis match where he started playing and kind of thought it would be a lot easier than it was and realized that, yeah, Murdoch's playing to win.
Which I have to say, it was at that moment that I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it he was kissing his behind like that.
I the influence of Murdoch is, I had no idea when now, I started reporting the story.
So in late October of last year, Colin Stretch, the general counsel for Facebook, and other executives from Google and Twitter were called to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee, a subcommittee. And it was all about Russian interference in the 2016 election. And that didn't go so well.
No, it didn't go so well. They didn't come across as open as they could be. But the Russia stuff, it really blindsided Facebook. They really didn't know the extent of the Russian propaganda operation on their platform until the summer of 2017, right? The stuff that had a huge influence on America the previous year and on the election until—
Even after Obama confronted Zuckerberg.
They knew about fake news. And they knew that there had been some Russian attempts to hack people's credentials. They did not know about the propaganda operation. They did not know that the IRA, Internet Research Agency, had created all of these groups to sort of spread lies and divide America. They didn't know that until there was a story in Time magazine in May of 17 where somebody says, an unnamed intelligence officer said that Russian propaganda groups had bought ads. And Facebook said, what? And so then they looked at all of the ads that had been purchased. They started to dig into the ad data. And by digging into the ad data, they found all these groups from the Internet Research Agency, the groups that had been, you know, Heart of Texas and Blacktivist, that had been designed to divide us. And so it was only in June and July of 17 that they found this stuff. Then they find it, and they kind of minimize it, and then they get hammered for minimizing it. And that's the context in which we have those congressional hearings.
Was there a decisive moment? Was there a breakthrough moment for Zuckerberg where he realized, no, it's not pretty crazy that we influenced this godforsaken election, but in fact, we have to own it and we have to change?
I think that there is a kind of a listening tour that he goes on in December, January, after the election, where he really gets an earful. And he starts to think. Then there's the revelation about the Russian ads, and then there's the congressional hearings. And those moments all just pound home exactly what's going on.
The overall impression here is of a really hard education for someone who is capable of shame. Not all executives are in the history of American business. It seems like Zuckerberg was capable of learning and of shame. And
yeah.
How do you illustrate that?
Well, maybe the best moment is, you know, every year he sets up a resolution. The first year it's he's going to wear ties. And then it's I'm going to run 365 miles or read a lot of books. And then this year he publishes his resolution and it's I'm going to fix Facebook. I know we've caused all these problems in the world and I'm going to dedicate myself to fixing it. And it was kind of a startling moment. He got mocked, right? Mark Zuckerberg's resolution is to do his job. But I read it and thought, this guy's really taking it to heart.
So on your Facebook feed, do you see any changes that are substantial since a year or two ago?
You know, one of the big changes has been deprioritizing what are called pages, which are sort of public pages. So that's, you know, institutional pages, and reprioritizing individual pages. So on the Nick Thompson public page, where I, you know, blast out Wired stories a couple times a day, lower engagement. On the Nick Thompson private page, where I share stories with my friends about my children, you know, more engagement. But I think in general, there's been a significant decline in traffic to the news industry through Facebook's changes over the last year.
And why is that great?
Well, I think over time what it will be is my hope and what has been told to me is that there will be a decline to news overall and there will be an increase for high-quality news.
So as an editor, as the editor of Wired and somebody who knows the news business very well, are you happier about Facebook now than you were a year ago?
I'm happier about Facebook than I was 3 months ago. I actually think the last 3 months have been good. And I think ultimately one reason why Facebook did allow us to talk to people at the end is they are proud of the story at the moment.
Well, you've got midterm elections coming up. What can we expect to see from Facebook? Will it make any difference in the way it did last time?
You know, I think the real test will be, do the most hyperpartisan candidates spreading the most outrageous statements win on either side? And if they do, it's a sign that Facebook is, you know, is not helping. You know, because what you don't want is you don't want a country where everybody goes to the extremes, where the only information that gets shared is nasty content. And you kind of
what if ideology is changing in the country and it's only reflecting that?
Yeah.
When you talked about extremes before, you referred to Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. What if that's what people want? In other words, there's a chicken and the egg problem here.
Yeah, it's a chicken and egg problem. My view is that it's due to lots of factors in American life, and surely cable television, demographics, geography, where we live, there are a thousand things that play into it. But I also think that Facebook contributes. So I guess the proper study would be to see whether the news that spreads, the political news that spreads on Facebook, is more partisan this time than last time. It's possible that that could all reverse. I mean, remember, the candidate who used Facebook the best before Donald Trump was this guy named Barack Obama, who wasn't particularly divisive or radical. So it's unclear whether the you know, Facebook will have this sort of ineluctable effect on how politics works. But we'll see in a year.
Nick, congratulations to you and Fred Vogelsang. It's a terrific piece and
thank
cover
you,
story of Wired this month.
Always a pleasure to come and talk with you. Thanks, David.
Nicholas Thompson is the editor of Wired. You can also find him talking about technology on CBS and CNN. Coming up, civil rights, women in Hollywood, and interplanetary travel. Just a few of the topics from a conversation with Ava DuVernay. It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Madeleine L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time is one of the most beloved fantasy novels around, and it's maybe surprising that we've never before seen the story in movie theaters. But a big Hollywood version of A Wrinkle in Time finally comes out next month with a cast that includes Oprah Winfrey and Reese Witherspoon. And there's one other surprising thing about the film. Its director, Ava DuVernay. DuVernay was hardly the obvious choice for a fantasy epic. She's best known for Selma, about the 1965 Civil Rights March, and she put out the documentary 13th about the prison system and its impact on Black America, and she's been making a TV series, Queen Sugar, about siblings who inherit a sugarcane farm in Louisiana. Ava DuVernay appeared at the New Yorker Festival in October with staff writer Jelani Cobb.
Thank you. Hi! Hey! Oh.
So we have been trying to get together to do this for a little while, and in terms of your shooting schedule and events and everything, but every year when we do this, people say, oh, who do you want to interview? I was like, I want to talk to Ava, because you have done so much in such a short period of time. And there, I guess I just want to start at the kind of earliest part of it, because there is a narrative that's really interesting. There's a thing that I think about in terms of geography and how geography sometimes means more than just space. Like for James Baldwin to get from Harlem to downtown where the publishing houses were, that was more than just, you know, four stops on the 2 train. It was a whole lot more than just geography. And so you are a native Californian, you're born in Long Beach, and I think there's a distance between Long Beach and Hollywood that's probably akin to that. So I'd like to talk a little bit about how you first came to love film.
Yeah, I got into film because I had an artist in my family who No one recognized him as an artist, never practiced art, but my Aunt Denise Amanda Sexton had an artist's heart. And, you know, the family did not encourage her to do all of the things that she had in her heart. And so she went to nursing school, and so she became a nurse. And she worked the night shift at hospitals all around Southern California for decades so that she could leave her days open to live the life that she wanted to live and experience art. So she became a huge patron of the arts. And so early on, we would do things that, you know, most people in Compton weren't doing. My mother, who did not understand what loved dearly, this amazing woman, was just like, oh, go with Denise to read white people books and go to white people concerts. So we would go do white people stuff. Book readings, you know what I mean? Or the play in downtown LA that seems so far from where we lived. And so every weekend, every week after school, on one particular day when there was cheap matinees, we would go and see movies. I would go in one and she would go in another, or we would go together. If it was an R movie, I would see my own, but it was a constant diet of film. And it was a magical time because I fell in love with the images, but I also, as I think about it more deeply, it's because I got to spend time with her. And it was offered to me with such love that now it's really the love of my life, that experience and creating that experience for other people.
And so I knew you in a kind of previous part of your career when you...
Did you?
Yeah, when we first met.
How did we first meet?
We first met in Atlanta in like 2000. Well, this is really getting to be embarrassing.
No, I've just known you for so long that if someone asked me, when did you first meet Jelani, I would have probably said college. Like, what did we...
You came to Atlanta, but I remember you telling me that you were going to, you had a PR company that you, you know, founded and ran, and you said that you were going to, we had a conversation once, and you said, yeah, I'm not going to be doing that anymore. I'm going into directing. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, I had no idea that you were interested in film.
Right.
And then the next thing I see is like this documentary that you've done, My Mic Sounds Nice.
Oh, right.
Which is your first documentary on women in hip hop.
Yeah. It was the second film I ever made. It was the first film that anyone ever gave me any money to make. So the first documentary I made was a film called This Is the Life about, I need one person. Look, props. Come on. This is going underground, deep down. Yes, thank you. You saw it too? Okay, too. I like that movie. It was made by hand for $10,000, check to check. It was when I first was saying, gosh, can I make films? Can I try to do this? Never went to film school, didn't pick up a camera until I was 32. But it was really a lot of steps to try to test myself and test how much I can tolerate in an industry that really is not built for me. But it was a beautiful experience, and it's a good film if you can find it. It's nowhere. You have it? Listen.
Oh.
Listen. Yes. It's a good little film. It's everything's imperfectly made when you're just starting, and even now, you're just not quite sure how to put it together, but it has a lot of heart.
So I just want to know, at some point, we officially transitioned into Black Church, where it's just like audience participation, welcome.
Call and respond. You know it's gonna happen.
We will be passing the collection. But talk more about this. You said an industry that wasn't made for you. And so talk to me a little bit about this, about that process of kind of getting into a place that, as you say, was not made for you.
Well, I work in an industry, if we take the industry side of things, not the actual work that I do, but the industry that monetizes that work, is built. I work in an industry built on the back of the film A Birth of a Nation. That is the film that started the whole industry upon which the studio system and a real thought about, wow, you can create critical mass around a piece of work and a real kind of peeping game by the very beginnings of an industry at that time. I mean, it was an industry made by white men, for white men, to make things for white men. And that's, you know, that I would love someone to try to dispute that. I think it would be a lively conversation. I would clearly win the debate, hands down. Or I'd just stick Jelani on and be like, let him know. And then, you know, just stand back. And so we could take him. But you know, this is what that industry was built upon. And so you have, you know, a century of work built on a framework that was flawed and that was exclusive to a certain kind of person and mindset. Mm-hmm. So I think the thing that made a difference for me in getting into the industry is I wasn't looking to get into the industry. Mm-hmm. So when I started, it wasn't an intention of one day I just want that Oscar if I can just get that. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know why I'm thinking about Oscar. Mm-hmm. I was just trying to make my thing and tell my stories and just wanted to see if I could craft what I loved. The only piece of the puzzle where I interrogate that statement for myself is that I continually, every time, applied to Sundance and got rejected 8 times. Mm-hmm. So on Middle of Nowhere, when it did make it into Sundance, into dramatic competition, which is the big category, and ended up winning Best Director, that's when everything changed and I had to really think about participating in the industry. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, the way that I got into the industry was very progressive, very step-by-step, and also very independent. Mm-hmm. On those very early meetings with studios and things, I would sit in with the real thought in my head of like, kind of like, oh, this is an interesting exercise in human behavior. You know what I mean? And not with a lot of expectation. And so everything that happened when I trace it back has really just been, not flukes, but things that I really wasn't trying to control. Mm-hmm. I was just enjoying making my projects. I was enjoying my work.
You know, in the midst of this, I think one of the things that also kind of struck me was seeing your voice develop from project to project. Mm. And even kind of becoming increasingly distinctive. And there's a clip, this is from Selma, obviously, one of your more recent works. But there's a clip in this that I want to show and then talk about kind of what you did as a filmmaker in this.
Okay.
What are we doing, Ralph? We take it piece by piece. Like we've been doing. We build the path as we came, rock by rock. His cell is probably bugged. It probably is. No, Lord. They're gonna ruin me so they can ruin this movement. They are. Look at the birds of the air. That they do not sow, nor reap, nor gather into barns. And yet your heavenly Father doth feed them. Are you not worth much more than they? And who of you, by being worried, can add a single hour to his life?
Matthew 6, verse 27.
All right.
Yes, sir.
I haven't seen that in a long time. Mm-hmm. I don't know if how the screen was or if you could see Dr. King's eyes or anything in there. It was a little dark, but when I look at that scene, I think of David Oyelowo and Coleman Domingo, the actors, and I think of Bradford Young, the cinematographer. Bradford.
That's what I was going to ask.
Okay.
Yeah.
No. Just talk about Brad. Bradford Young. Gosh, I don't want to even get emotional. I just talked to him this morning, like for 2 hours this morning, and we haven't talked in so long. Because I'm making A Wrinkle in Time, and he's just making this little thing called Star Wars. And he's been gone for like, that brother's been gone for 2 years, like making that. And I just miss him so much, and I see that, and I talk with him today, and I just feel emotional, because I remember that was our first day of shooting Selma. It was the first scene we did. And I remember we were talking about the lighting, and I was like, look, it's an Alabama jail in the middle of the night in the dank, dark, I need it to look like the hull of a slave ship in there. Don't give me no fake, this is prison light, right? It was a horrible place where they put too many people in one cell. If at the top of the scene, you would see bodies all around. It was cold. It was no light. It was nowhere to go to the bathroom. We need to try to capture what it was. Just give me a little something through the window. Yet he's like, yeah, yeah. And when he turns out, you're not going to see nothing but like just a little, maybe a little outline of the eye. I'm like, yeah, yeah, let's do that. I was like, yeah. But anyway, in this scene, this is the first day of dailies. Mm. So the studio gets what they call dailies, which is every day they see what you shot the night before. So they look at the dailies and they're like, yeah, it's dark. Did you want to see Dr. King's eyes at any point in the thing? We're like, yeah, no, no, we like it like this. And they're like, eh, yeah, we think we've given you the money and we'd like to see his eyes in the thing. And so Brad's like, there's space in there. We can turn up the eyes, you know? So we take it into the color and we turn up the whites of his eyes and we do all these tricks to show them. And nothing else in the film is this dark, but it was very intentional that it feel like the space. Yeah.
But there's actually another thing about that clip, and I don't want to dwell on it for too long, because I know you only want to talk about Martin Luther King some of the time.
No, I love it.
Do you know what I liked about that scene, as the historian in me liked about that scene, was that we have been given this vision of MLK as this singular entity who's just radiating inspiration and power to all the people around, you know, and he's the pinnacle of this expression of freedom, a desire to be free, that stretches from 1619 up until he arrives.
Right.
And you inverted that. And that's not the only time you did that in the film. Like, in many instances, you see King leaning, sometimes heavily, on the people around him and, you know, displaying self-doubt and not sure he can actually do what history is commanding him to do, and almost certainly can't do it without the other people around him.
Right. You know, I couldn't, as a Black woman who was a, you know, history buff and major, and my father is from Lowndes County, Alabama. Lowndes County is the county, my father. Love him, miss him so much, just recently passed. Between Selma and Montgomery is a county called Lowndes County. Between Selma and Montgomery, when they walked from Selma to the capital of Montgomery, they had to walk through Lowndes County. My father, 5 years old, was one of the kids standing out waving as Dr. King and the people walked by, the little country kids in the deep, deep rural South. My father's from there, and his daughter ends up making a film called Selma. So when I get the script and it doesn't have any, it's called Selma. Shouldn't there be some people from Selma in the movie, or no, just stay in the White House? Let's just get the people from Selma in the movie. And you can't have King. This isn't what King was. He was a man.
A human being.
He was a human being. Right. So all of those things that we put in, I'm so happy that you saw that in it. And some people who had just thought of him as the monument or the holiday now have a sense of him as a flesh and blood human being. Yeah.
That's Ava DuVernay at the New Yorker Festival in 2017, speaking with Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at the New Yorker. More from DuVernay in a minute. She'll talk about why her upcoming film, A Wrinkle in Time, might be different than anything we've seen before. That's in a minute on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've just been hearing Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at the magazine, in conversation with Ava DuVernay. She's best known as the director of Selma, and her adaptation of the fantasy novel A Wrinkle in Time comes out in March. DuVernay is also the creator of the TV series Queen Sugar, and it tells the story of three siblings who inherit a sugarcane farm.
He'd never expect us to be tied up to the land now that we're grown.
Tied up? You make it sound like a burden.
You know what I mean. We're just kids.
Yeah, I don't think Daddy would expect us to do this now.
He did. He told me that's what he wanted.
When?
Last week. Last month. All the time. Oh, so y'all think I'm lying?
No, but Rob, come on. None of us knows a thing about running a farm.
I do. Me and Blue helped out Pop all the time.
Running a farm is a lot of hard work.
Man, come on. What's the harm in trying?
Jelani Cobb asked DuVernay about the show at the New Yorker Festival in 2017.
So you have now been distinguished in documentary, distinguished in feature film, and then Queen Sugar comes along.
Yeah. It's been, God, I love television. I just think, I mean, it's the elongated story. Usually as a filmmaker, I got 2 hours max. With a series, I mean, Queen Sugar, 13 episodes, 16 episodes a year. Like, we're writing right now the third year of this, like, this family in its third year. So to think about characters and situations in such a long arc, allowing you to see someone grow, and, like, if you want to show a character who's formerly incarcerated, if you want to show a character who's battling addiction, you don't have to just do a very special episode of Queen Sugar and do it once. Like, you can see, you know, how these issues and these personal problems affect and change and morph in people just like they do in our own families. Mm-hmm. And I think God, I'm just in love with it. So Queen Sugar is my baby. You know, I love that show. I love everyone associated with it. And all the white people are like, what's Queen Sugar? That's not true. That's not fair. We have white people who watch Queen Sugar. Are there any white people out there who might have seen Queen Sugar? It's a lady, a beautiful blonde woman right in the middle, a brunette behind her. She knows. She knows Ralph Angel, too.
You are still doing focus groups, Ava. Like, this is pulling together a focus group here. The question I was actually trying to segue into, though, was about the number of directors, the number of female directors that you brought.
The number is all.
All, yeah.
The number is every one of them. And for the second season, which we're in the middle of right now, and for the future seasons, that's what the DNA of our show. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's in my view, it's righting a wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, someone came up to me. God, I probably shouldn't say this. Oh well. Someone came up to me and said, called me actually, a really lovely person, and said, you know, you may want to be careful with this because, you know, people can see it as discrimination. Discriminating against men. And I said, took a deep breath on the phone, and I said, I would welcome that conversation. I said, I would welcome that lawsuit. I would welcome that whatever, because it exposes. I mean, you don't want me to go through all the shows that have had only men for decades upon decades upon decades, and no one raised a hand, no one sued for us, no one, you don't want to open the can. But if you want to open the can, we can do it. We can go there if you would like. It's up to y'all. But let's not. Let's not. Let's just keep going forward and say that there are some shows that are using their, you know, this platform as a corrective measure to highlight and to incubate and to bring more women into the industry, an industry that has shut us out and continues to shut us out for far too long.
Yeah, I think we've had a conversation, given, you know, what the allegations about Harvey Weinstein look like. And I'm not going to ask you about that specifically, but I'll ask you in a general sense, like, how prevalent are those behaviors and how prevalent are those sorts of issues in the industry now? I think people thought of this as a kind of old Hollywood behavior, but...
Like casting couch?
Yeah,
kind of,
yeah.
I mean, it's not old. I think it exists whenever there are... whenever there's power dynamics at play. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Someone is going to try to make a power play. And so if you have an industry that is run by men, for men, the content, I mean, literally 97% of directors of the top 1,000 grossing films over the past 10 years, 97%, 97% are men. That means almost everything you've seen at the movies over the last 10 years has been through the lens eye of a male director. And just to let you know what directors do, they make all the decisions about what you wear, how you sit, what you say, where the light is, who the camera favors. 97% men, right? 79% white. And so it's a sad thing, but it's across issues of men and women. It's across, you know, issues of black, white, brown. It's across issues of people with all kinds of different, sexual and gender identity. And I mean, even when you look at the transgender community, and I apologize at the top if I don't use all the right terminology to describe things. I'm trying to learn a lot about the transgender community and trying to be supportive of rights for all. But I know that even like 5 years ago, I wasn't even thinking about it. I felt like a white person in that. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need to know this. You know what I mean? Like, it really is a way for people of color, I think. It's been a way for me to interrogate and understand the kind of white privilege when you think of it in terms of, you know, of the privilege that I enjoy, you know, as a heterosexual woman, right? I don't have to think about that, right? But somebody else has to think about that every single day. They can't even move in the world without thinking about it. And how we've changed our attitudes, our mind, through awareness, through recognition, through our own interrogation of what's right and what's wrong. If we could all just do that in a larger spectrum, we see examples of how it can work. Mm-hmm. You know, if we can't focus on or relate to the civil rights movement because it was so long ago, interrogate in your own minds the way that you've changed your mind about something that even 5 years ago you thought differently about. It's possible. You know what I mean? It's possible for us to change ourselves and in doing so change, you know,
the world.
Change the world. I mean, it's true. Yeah, it's true.
So I know folk would be very unhappy with me if we got out of here and didn't talk about Wrinkle in Time.
Oh, great.
And so we have a clip here that we're going to show, and then we can talk for
a second.
Is it
a trailer?
It's a trailer,
okay,
right.
Like, how'd you get a clip out of my editing room? Okay.
We smuggled a clip
in. I was going to say, yes.
What if we are here for a reason? What if we are a part of something truly divine? Imagine 91 billion light years traveled like that.
Sweet dreams are made of this.
Your father has accomplished something extraordinary, also dangerous. Trapped by a darkness that's actively spreading throughout the universe. And the only one who can stop it is you. Be a warrior.
I'll try.
So, I mean, this is a really kind of impressive array of work. And how did you come to this story?
Yeah, no, it's interesting looking at that because we're really, really in the weeds on trying to finish the movie right now. And I'm in a place right now where it's, when I was talking to Bradford this morning, he said, how are you feeling about it? And for the first time out loud, I said, you know, I don't know. You know, I love it. You know, I feel something very deep in my gut when the Oprah's voice says, you know, there's a darkness in the world, and the only one who can stop it, and smash cut to a black girl. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you know? I don't know if people are gonna feel that like I feel it. I don't know if the people who I wanna see it will come see it. I don't know if the people who have certain expectations of what the book was are gonna be interested in these different, I've got a lot of great feedback, but it is about a girl saving the world, and that girl is a girl of color. Mm-hmm. It's not shied away from, it is front and center. Like, she is hopping planets and flying and like saving the friggin' world. She's like saving the world. She's saving the world from darkness. And in the film, darkness is defined as the darkness within us, right? She's saving us from ourselves. It's deep. Like, the book is written by this woman named Madeleine L'Engle, who published it in 1963. She was rejected by 29 publishers. I was like, lady, in 1963, we don't know what all this is, but Mara, you know, are you Christian? Are you not Christian? Are you a communist? I mean, it's spirituality, it's social commentary, it's spectacle, it's like a crazy thing. And, you know, there's not a lot of women working on a studio level on fantasy and creating worlds and all of that. And I just feel like, you know, how much of this is going to be embraced? You're seeing worlds being built through the point of view of a Black woman from Compton. So when I'm told, create a planet, my planet's going to look different from my white male counterpart's planet, who we've seen 97% of the time. And so, but so you're used to seeing that. And is this going to be as palatable, as interesting, as intriguing? These are all questions that have not been, we've only barely begun to ask the question with Patty Jenkins' great work in Wonder Woman, right? What do worlds through a woman visionary's lens even look like? I don't know. I think it's probably, maybe like in 20 years, someone will pull it up as a cult classic. Like, maybe they'll wheel me out of my wheelchair and be like, this was good after all. You know what I mean? We were wrong at that time. But we'll see. And thank you all for coming. I really, really appreciate it. I appreciate it so much. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Ava DuVernay at the New Yorker Festival in 2017, speaking with Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at the New Yorker. Now, I come to the magazine business and the radio business, for that matter, as a journalist. That's what I know, and that's what I get excited about and stress about. So the time I spend with my colleagues looking at cover illustrations and cartoons and photographs is a real pleasure. I went to see the New Yorker's director of photography, Joanna Milter, thinking that she'd show me some cool pictures or some other kind of visual inspiration. But no, Joanna wanted to talk about one thing and one thing only, pro basketball. More specifically, her team from her city, the Cavaliers.
Greatest moment of your life. It's going to take her 10 minutes to recover.
I actually get teary every time I see it.
Yeah.
I really do.
Well, I'm here with my colleague, Joanna Milter. Usually we talk about photography, and I thought we were going to be talking about an Henri Cartier-Bresson show or Stephen Shore show, but no. No way. It's all hoop, isn't it?
All basketball, all the time.
So what have you got on your mind?
So my first pick is a person, actually, Doris Burke. Doris Burke is the first woman to do color commentary for an NBA season, starting this season, actually.
And I have to say, we once went to a Cavs-Knicks game, and you saw Doris Burke 8 feet away. It was like Elvis had entered the building.
That's the way I feel about Doris. She's my Elvis. And what I love about Doris is she knows her basketball, and she also is great in the moment, in the dramatic moment. She's got this amazing voice. Her voice kind of has this tremulous quality to it. And she did the interview with LeBron James after the Cavs won the championship in 2016. She was the first person to interview LeBron.
No worries, Kyrie. LeBron, as soon as that buzzer sounded, your emotions let loose. Can you describe what you're feeling right now?
LeBron is he's 6'8", 250 pounds. He's sobbing. He's crying. He's on the floor crying. And then she does the first interview with him.
Cleveland! This is for you!
Oh! LeBron, you did what no other team had been able to do, coming back from a 3-1 deficit in the finals. And to do that, you had to win twice in a place that proved too much for so many teams.
I think the genius of Doris is that she makes you believe that she's pro your team. And in a way, because she loves basketball so much, in a way she is. She's rooting for all of them.
If I told you you could replace Doris Burke and no longer be director of photography at The New Yorker, I pretty much feel it's a foregone conclusion, right?
I guess, although I don't think I have her talent.
Don't sell yourself short. Okay, now what is your second pick?
Okay, so my second thing is a Twitter account called Fear the Sword. It's part of a sports blog for Cavs fans. I love it. It's petty and funny, and they have some running gags that I think are hilarious. For example, Dwayne Wade played briefly for the Cavs this year. He's an amazing player. He won 3 championships with the Miami Heat.
He's about, what, 52?
His knees are 52. So Fear the Sword has this running gag where they act as if Wade has been with the Cavs his entire career. I should mention that the Cavs did just trade him back to the Heat, but while he was with the Cavs, they acted as if he'd been with the Cavs for his entire career, and his career in Miami didn't even exist. So, for example, during a game, they'll say things like, 15 years in with the Cavs and those Dwayne Wade floaters still feel like new, is one. Yeesh, 15 years in Cleveland and Wade is still tormenting the Heat, during a game where they're playing the Heat.
I think this is the ultimate inside joke.
What,
yeah,
how
go
about
ahead.
This?
You might as well be reading Romanian. Four steals on 4 possessions. That's why it's called Wade County Amorite, folks.
Yep.
Can't miss that stuff. What's your third pick?
My third pick. Okay, I am glad that I picked this because I've been trying to get you to watch this for years. So there was a documentary made in 2008, and it was about LeBron's high school team. The guy who made the documentary, he went to LeBron's high school. So he started shooting this documentary when LeBron was still in high school.
What's the name of the documentary?
It's called More Than a Game.
They totally hit the ground running, and they instantly had a chemistry, and they started blowing teams out.
You can see the cohesiveness. It takes teams time to develop that. They had it as soon as they were freshmen.
Every time we go out on the floor, we want to play 110%. And that's what we did tonight.
Now, isn't it true that if LeBron played with 4 mice in high school, he'd probably win every game?
Well, that's probably true.
15, Joanna, thank you. 20,
thanks, David.
And the buzz is clicking.
The Eagles fall from the ranks of the unbeaten while the Irish roll on. St. Bee proves worthy of that top ranking.
We just established who was the best.
It's kind of cool, I think. Hey, guys.
Joanna Milter is the director of photography for The New Yorker and one day maybe point guard for the Cavs. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for listening. Next week, don't miss the show because we're going to be handing out the film industry's absolutely most coveted and glamorous awards, the Brodies, only at The New Yorker Radio Hour. See you then.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with special help from Rhonda Sherman, David Ohana, Hillary Lecter Griffin, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Tarina Endowment Fund.